question. Do you know how hard it is to clean poo out of a monogrammed sweater? Do you know how expensive it is to try to get poo out of a sweater?
We'll make a receipt to that effect that I can turn into the insurance company.
American Vandal season number 2 dropped. It's Brown Friends by the Lake last Friday, and Jeb Lund joins me for an exposition dump. Later, we'll talk about the Doodler murders and how it's remained mostly overlooked as a major case, with one long-form exception. We hope you'll give a crap about The Blotter Presents, episode 69. Hello everyone, welcome back to The Blotter Presents, where we explore the principle that crime is bad, but some of the stories about it can be pretty damn good. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, your host, and I am joined for the first time by Jeb Lund. Hello, Jeb.
Hello, I'm honored to be part of the greater previously.tv podcast ensemble.
We're honored to have you. I'm thrilled that you came on to talk about American Vandal season number 2. for our most wanted section. American Vandal, I don't think it's fair to characterize it as a like parody at this point, because it is as a parody of true crime properties, very sharply observed, and especially in season 1, I think they hit all the right notes on that tip. But I think it's really much more than that. A friend of mine tweeted something yesterday to the effect of that 13 Reasons Why tries to be what American Vandal is almost effortlessly, which I thought was interesting. I have watched both shows. But here is the case file for season 2, in case you're not familiar. In the wake of their first documentary success, Peter and Sam seek a new case and settle in a stomach-churning mystery at a Washington State high school. Yeah, so the season 1 mystery is, of course, who drew the dicks, and season 2 is who is the turd burglar who is responsible for the brownout, which is like the lemonade was poisoned and basically everyone who drank it in the cafeteria that day shit themselves. There is quote social media found footage that I have to tell you, this is a very triggery. Like if you really don't like this kind of thing, like if you were one of those people that tried to go to the Jackass movies and had to leave because you felt ill, this is a little tough to get through in parts.
Right. Yeah,
especially because like the, I mean, the prop design is, it's really, really something. And some of the sound effects, we'll get into it. But there was that, and then someone put dried cat shit into a t-shirt cannon for a pep rally. And then there was some kind of pinata exercise in an English teacher's class, and the pinata was filled with Duke. So yeah, it's really a lot of poo. I think like dicks are a little bit funnier than poo, but I don't think it's necessarily the point for it to be funny. It's not the only point of the show is for it to be funny. Would you say what do you say? Which one did you think was funnier?
I think the dicks is just funnier because the who drew the dicks thing is just such a great question, and it nobody really gets hurt by looking at a bad picture of a dick. I was reading an interview with the creators about this season, and they said that the reason that they chose to go with you know, all this sort of scatological horror was that it was the easiest way of mirroring the images that you see in true crime documentaries of like blood smeared on the
right.
walls. And, you know, the sort of the gruesome photos of bodies with pools underneath them. And that makes total sense to me. I thought it was funny. Just, I don't know, maybe I just have had like a lot of bad luck with, you know, having birds poop on me or you know, treading in dog poop and that kind of stuff over the course of my life. So it wasn't like, oh, the horror. But I remember I talked to somebody, talked to a couple people yesterday about it, and I was surprised that they were as grossed out as they were. To me, it was just kind of like, I don't know, watching people like uncontrollably poop themselves, because I think everybody's probably done that like at least once as a child, like the, you know, they're in the drugstore that, you know, only has one bathroom and they got to go and they don't tell their dad soon enough, you know, like there is something kind of like childlike and you know, comical, because everybody's sort of getting humiliated in this, or I guess not humiliated, but like just sort of embarrassed in this like completely accessible and immediate, dare I say, urgent yes. way.
Indeed. Emergent, you might say. Here is the 911 call from the first episode in which we are introduced to the horror that was the brownout. Here's clip two.
911, what's your emergency?
He's a call from St. Bernardine Catholic.
Yes, ma'am.
All of our students, I don't know how to say, they're all sick. They're all pooping. I don't know, it happened around lunchtime, and it was just a few students, and then all of them started running to the bathroom.
I wanted to die. We had no choice. I mean, most of us just shit our pants right in front of everyone.
I realized right away this wasn't the work of spoiled fish sticks. This was an attack.
Before it was all over, it had a name. The brownout.
Okay, you can't really tell, but about 10 seconds from the end of that clip, you can hear in the background, amidst all the shrieking and running, someone slipping in a puddle of someone else's poo and hitting the deck in her white tights. And it's like, this is an extremely relatable scenario, while it's also hilarious and disgusting. But what it took me a few episodes for this to occur to me, but this is like, there were a bunch of sort of reference that were coming up for me, including like documentary series that I've watched about false confessions, the Jinx, whatever else, which I think is on purpose. But I wonder how purposeful the relationship to footage of school shootings was, because this is, you know, haha, like, yeah, it's traumatizing, but just in a social way. But what you're hearing in that clip is like screaming and panic and a 911 call. And I wonder what the creators were thinking in terms of that relationship, or if it's just coincidental because it took place at a school. Were you getting that at all, or am I?
You know, I don't know whether to just give them credit for being that smart or give me credit for being that dumb, that it didn't occur to me until you said that. I'm not really sure.
Why can't it be both?
One of the things I was thinking as I was watching it, and I went back and watched parts of the first season too, is just how thoroughly empathetic the creators are to almost everybody. You know, even the kind of, you know, even the clownish people are treated as three-dimensional humans, and horror is treated. I mean, this whole season has a lot of stuff that's very current in the discourse, as an uncomfortable topic, and they managed to filter it down into this absurd lens that takes some of the sting out of it. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if they thought, well, okay, why don't we, this is our recreation of a school shooting, in the least, you know, no pun intended, like triggering way possible.
Right. Well, and I think also, I mean, I'll get back to this idea a little bit later, but I think that where the comparison comes in for me also is how sharply observed the high school experience is. I mean, whatever, my high school experience took place like practically in the Victorian era, at least as far as technology was concerned. Like three-way calling was how you screwed someone over, not Facebook. But I feel like this is almost documentary and not mockumentary in terms of the emotions and conflicts that it's bringing out amongst all the characters. So
right, yeah, and the I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but like the ease with which people who are alienated can be radicalized to these actions against their fellow students by just sort of like the flimsiest rationales that all make sense. It's like,
yeah, well, and that's another way in which it ties into school shootings, at least yeah. It did for me, that you know, this was the alienation in this case, but it could have been anything, and it could have been something even smaller. This show, I think, has always been really smart about the meta aspects of itself. So our next clip is how Peter explains the involvement of Netflix, which at first he says he thought was Sam fucking with him. Here's clip three.
Netflix allowed us to reach a wider audience and to add some additional production value, like drone shots, an original score, opening credits, and 3D graphics. It brought new life to our documentary, even though many of the fans thought the changes robbed it of some of the Vimeo version's original charm. Since season one was released on Netflix, the response has been incredible.
Please welcome Peter Maldonado and Sam Eklund.
It put us on the national stage in a way we could have never anticipated.
The biggest question facing this country right now, who drew the dicks?
Just hearing him say it in that accent, who drew the dicks, is great. And they're very clever about how not only they explain certain extremely professional elements of season one that we've now already seen, but also how Peter and Sam wind up sucked into the mystery of the turd burglar. And here's clip four, which I mostly included because of this little like found snippet of this guy talking about how he doesn't know how they burned a dick into the football field, but they did it. Here's clip four.
There was a staggering number of people who contacted us about their school's dick drawing controversies. For example, someone burnt a dick into the 50-yard line of their school's football field.
I'm not sure if it was weed killer or, lighter fluid, but we had to resod the whole field.
Then there was a spray-painting vagina vandal in Texas, a serial pool pisser in a high school in Wisconsin, a Navy pilot who drew a dick in the sky, and a real murder that, for some reason, someone thought Sam and I should figure out. But with the exception of that murder, nothing seemed worth a deeper investigation. Until I was contacted by Chloe Lyman.
Hi, Peter. My name is Chloe Lyman, and I'm a junior at St. Bernardine Catholic. I'm contacting you today because we have a vandal. He goes by the name the Turd Burglar.
This one really grabbed me.
I just love, first of all, Peter's extreme seriousness in describing all the people that reached out to him about prospective cases, and also kind of the drive-by shade towards, like, the Maura Murray podcast and Reddit and all of that in that, like, well, for some reason they thought we should solve a real murder. Like, yeah, exactly. That's the internet for you. But yeah,
I was just going to say, they also got the way that, you know, everybody, whenever you see something that kind of goes virally popular, everybody immediately wants you to do like just the same thing again, like just a different version of it. And like, these guys got to the bottom of the dick problem. You know what? I really want to see him solve a dick problem.
Yeah, exactly.
And so like a nice little nod to people, like, what are they going to do this season? Well, we're not going to do that again.
Yeah. Well, and on the eve of Serial returning for its third season, as you're listening to this, it'll be dropping tomorrow. And we'll be talking about it next week. But that's definitely something that I think Sarah Koenig has been dealing with since like the second episode of Serial. Is like, well, how are you going to keep doing this exact thing? Like, well, that's, you know, that's not how that works exactly. But I thought this was a really clever workaround on their part. And the build of this show, like that they use these kids, there were more recognizable actors this time, but mostly the kids look like kids and are kids. They almost never sort of like cheat the narrative. Like there's one spot sort of in a later episode where it's like, I'm not sure why the documentary is acting like is telling us something that Peter and Sam are then pretending they don't know later in the same episode. but that's very seldom. Like, I don't know how I would go about doing this and then continuing it for a second season in this like seamless a way. And they really did a great job.
I think, you know, I didn't, you know, I'm interested to hear what you say that was, because I didn't notice it. And it might have been just like dad fatigue and involuntarily nodding off on the couch. And I might have just missed that second. But there is so much of that to Serial and to these other ones of like, well, let's go back to the Nisha call. And right. You know, you from one episode, like as soon as you discover a fact, there's almost always something to undermine its like certain veracity. Yeah. And so like even things that you can say they just learned, they can cast enough doubt on that, you know, you can proceed as if it wasn't learned. I don't know. So like that might be the one instance in which I would give them credit. The one thing I was going to say, just from what you said about how well they make it seem like kids are legitimately doing this, they don't do it a lot. But one of the things I enjoyed very much out of both seasons is there's like two instances, and I wish I could remember in particular one at this moment, where somebody kind of just reminds them, like, you're just two kids from high school with cameras. Like, we don't really have to cooperate with you.
Yeah.
And like, they've made so much progress that you can kind of see, like, both of them go like, oh shit, yeah, they're right. Like, they don't have to obey us. We don't have subpoena power.
Well, and there's also a moment like very late in season two when DeMarcus is sort of explaining it all for you in terms of his involvement in what turns out to be the larger scheme. That and this actor is amazing and has this
so good.
Very heartfelt, believable, but not like actory or overwritten explanation. And then there's a pause, and then at the end of that scene, and you've sort of forgotten that Sam is there because he's not on camera. He's like, so Sam, you saw my dick, right?
Yes.
And Sam's like, Sam is one of my favorites across both seasons. Like, his extremely passionately argued, like when he's like, that's not holding it in, that's straining, when they're looking at McLean in the brownout footage. It's so good. He's like, well, what position do you make? Like, what are you doing in this position? And then he's like making grunting noises. That kid is amazing.
You know, just coming back to what you said, that, I mean, which I think is such a right on compliment about like, it's everything that 13 Reasons Why wants to think it is. And like that scene just was so evocative of like so many things so many conversations I've had where, you know, like there's a release, you know, like of somebody's nudes or something. And, you know, I'll talk to like a woman journalist and say like, did you look at them? And yeah.
Yeah.
And like, well, but you know, that's a violative thing to do. It's like, yeah. And I feel awful, but yeah. And like, just that kind of like human moment of like this secret I'm not supposed to know is available. I will like squint out of the corner of my eye and, you know, immediately feel like a lesser person for having done it. And that ties in somewhat, I think, to Sam, and the dilemma in season one, where that was like so beautifully done toward the end, where the girl who allegedly gave the dockside hand job says like, what the fuck did this have to do with the vandalism? Why did you pursue it? And there is that moment where he's kind of confronted with like, in your desire to know everything, you kind of forget that there are a lot of things you really don't need to know.
Yeah.
And you're like trying to hide behind the ethical commitment of like, as a journalist and a documentarian, right, I feel it incumbent upon me to discover all the truth. It's like, no, there's a lot of truth you don't need.
Yeah, it's true. I think that the way that they illustrate that without underlining it is really good. Like, and the way that they bring in the sort of constant unconscious awareness that kids that age have of Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, and that's always, and that your data is never erased and all that. And that's like a constant background element of their lives at all times. And they do use the verb to catfish, but I think they did such a good job of, you know, making me glad that I'm old and that this isn't something that, like, that I could go home from school and I was like done with that.
And I think about this all the time. My half brother, my half sister is still in high school. My half brother is almost 18 years younger than I am. And because they started high school after the age of social media, I remember I sat down and I was talking to him one time and I said, I feel really bad because you're never going to have a period where you go away.
Yeah.
Like everybody I knew got to graduate high school. Like the America Online discs were all showing up in our mail like senior year. Uh-huh. Right. But it wasn't like a thing that everyone was doing. And so you could, and you know, MySpace didn't come out for like another decade. So you had 10 years to go and get thinner or bulkier or, you know, hotter or, you know, calmer or chiller. And you didn't have to have this paper trail. And that's to me is like, seems, especially like watching even on like social media now with adults, like the fact that a misgiven moment where somebody like maybe, you know, kind of like trash talks a colleague or something, you know, it winds up in print. There's a paper trail. And it's something that other people can stew over and inflate and ruminate on and resent with like far more focus than like a transient comment that you might make like at the food court where you're like, I think that guy's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And the next day you're not irritated with them and somebody's like, what do you think about Malcolm? Ah, he's all right. You know, he's kind of annoying sometimes, but you know, I don't want to trash him or nothing. Right. But like if you print it, then you have to reckon with that. And like that, the final episode is so good talking about their navigation of like those two different lives, like one in which like everything is transient, like normal people, and you can start it, you know, again with a new day. And then this other kind of realm that they're trapped in and they can never let go of. Cause like, that's how you have to fucking function.
Yeah.
Like to know people, you know, at this point, like, that where there's just always going to be like this chain of custody of like evidence against their being in a bad mood about, you know, their friend Kim.
Yeah. And there's such a like quantification of your friendship and your social status, like that, you know, the easy comparison is that Black Mirror episode with Bryce Dallas Howard. But that's something that always was true. We just didn't have, like, there weren't numbers of likes and numbers of like thumbs ups or, you know, crying laughing emojis. You'll see in our visual aids, which as always will be on our social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. But there was one extremely serious Chiron talking about the Shitstain McLean guy. I guess the one who came up that they're all talking in talking heads about how, quote, it made Nick Sondergoth. And then they're talking about how Kevin's birthday party numbers fell off over the next 2 years. Actually, we have a clip, so let me just play that and then we'll keep talking about this.
You went from like a 35-person birthday party in the fifth grade
to
like a 3-person birthday party in the sixth.
After that, he created this sort of persona where he had to be the smartest person in the room all the time.
There was a month in eighth grade where he just spoke in a British accent for no reason.
I mean,
you cut it off before my favorite line, which was like, it seemed like he was always doing an impression of a really smart person.
Oh yeah, that was good too. My esteemed colleague and work wife Tara Ariano and I were talking on Twitter a couple days ago about how Netflix really. There's another character who's like this that she cited, I think maybe Anne with an E, which I stopped watching after like two episodes, but they're really good at a certain type of like performative weirdo who's not like in the bottom tier of the society in high school, but is like one tier up, which was me. And I think also Tara. And we were just talking about how I was like, quote, known for wearing a different lapel pin on my neon oversized overcoat every day. because that's what happens in girls' school when you're 15 and you have no perspective on anything, that you're like going to have a thing.
And oh yeah. No, I private elementary school for like 2 years, and like every guy wore their like, cause you could wear a polo or a button down and everybody had a slightly different thing. Mm-hmm. And like certain people, when you tie your school sweatshirt around your waist, like some people tied it with like the knot right on the front, and then some people kind of on the side, and then some people did it over the shoulders, like a, you know, like let's go to the regatta.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, my brother, yeah. Before they finally eliminated the uniforms at his school, but there was a whole thing with the belt, like where the buckle was going to be.
Yeah.
And my brother was a like Adrian Smith in Grease 2 guy, where he would fasten it like one thing over, which I still do, because that was actually cool. My brother is actually cool. I have never been cool for a second in my life. But the way that this show talks about like coolness and being accepted, and like not just the quality of life for high school kids socially, but how it's now measured in quantity as well, is yeah. really smart. And also makes me glad again that I do not have children, because my heart would just be breaking for them every second. Like,
yeah,
it's, you know, it's very easy to be like, homeschooling, give me a break. But then you see shit like this and you're like, oh yeah, homeschooling, that's what you do. that's the way.
There's a bit in the first season that does that too, where the guy who like rats out the meathead and claims that he saw him spray painting the dicks, they say he got 800 more Instagram followers from that.
Yes.
But like, I'd like where your head's at with the main character, Kevin McLean, and also like the main character from the first one, Dylan.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing wrong with them. I mean, like Dylan's an oaf, right? But like he's, you know, and like he does some not cool stuff that's just clear that he doesn't really think about the consequences of it. But once you explain it to him, you know, he's got that, oh shit. Yeah.
And he's a familiar kinda oaf. Like this is this is a known oaf who exists in the world.
we've analyzed over 2,000 different oafs of similar character, and we can predict
we've
that his
oaf entered
is this.
Him into oaf cap, and this this is an oaf of type 7. Oaves is my favorite. Well done.
But thank you. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, like Kevin McLean, like, you know, these are both guys that, you know, you 5 years out of high school, you're delighted to see them again because you're no longer in the crucible with them. And there's no longer that narcissism of small differences that makes you take like these little tweaks of like Kevin is the fruit ninja and make you go like, oh, that guy's what an asshole. Like, and as soon as you're out of it, you go like, oh, well, you know, it's actually kind of cool that guy just did his thing. Like, I was sitting there, I spent 4 years going, well, shit, I can't wear that because this person will make fun of me. And I can't dress, I can't do this because that group will make fun of me. And this guy just owned it and was like, well, nobody's going to like me, so I'm just going to do weird shit that entertains me. And like, you know, if the brownout thing doesn't happen, this is exactly the sort of guy that everybody wants to talk to 10 years later to see, like, what did that guy wind up doing?
Well, and it also seemed like this was not someone that people minded talking to. Even then, like the shit stain McLean thing was like, all right, well, everybody knew about that, but nobody really talked about it. And the talking head interviews with these other kids, like some of them are like, yeah, we don't understand why he's like that, but they didn't seem to mind him. And I like that about this show. You mentioned it before that the show has empathy for everyone, but I also like that they let their characters not be, you know, even like tertiary or quadruciary people talking about Kevin's pretensions to what was the drink? Horchata? He's obsessed with tea. But then that moment where his friend brings him like this peace offering of tea and he's like, well, actually I was talking about the other vintage, but I'm told this vintage is quite good as well. Better, in fact. Like, it's really this moment of growth for this character socially. But then so many of the other characters are like, yeah, Fruit Ninja was pretty funny. Like, I would have lived for Fruit Ninja at that age.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, a Fruit Ninja thing is happening, let's photobomb it. I don't know. I would have thought that was funny. But yeah.
I also, like, I think a lesser show, too, would have just, like, leaned on the shit-stained McClane. So, like, for people who haven't seen it yet, you know, in fourth grade, he sits down on a muddy field, and it looks like he, you know, he gets a stain on his shorts, and it looks like he pooped his pants, and this other guy, the Sondergoth or whatever, is, like, shit-stained McClane. And for the adults, it's like, oh, well, that, you know, he would never let that go. And, like, people let that, I mean, even something as petty as high school, people let that go. Like, I'll tell an embarrassing story. Like, I used to have an undeveloped lot next to my house, and my mom would make me go out there and, like, clear cut it because it would grow with kudzu, like, into our yard.
Right.
And there was, like, poison ivy all through it. And you'd try your best not to get poison ivy, but you just get poison ivy. And, like, I got it all over the insides of my thighs, my abdomen, and, like, near the sensitive areas. And then, like, eighth grade field day, there's a picture that somebody took of, like, three girls, you know, who are, like, on the dance team, like, all going, like, hey, cheese, you know, like, it's field day or whatever. And I'm in the back, like, just fucking digging away at the inside of my thigh. And it just looks like I'm really, really, like, grinding at my junk.
Oh.
And I was, and somebody showed that to me, and they gave me shit about it for, like, a week. And I thought, this is never going to go away. This is going to haunt me for 1,000 years. And, like, nobody remembered it by the next year. And, like, nobody brought it up. I was the only person who brought it up. And by that point, I was laughing at it. You know, like, by senior year, I was like, you remember the really embarrassing thing I did? And then, you know, other people are like, no, I did something way more embarrassing.
Oh, everybody's got one of those. Mine was sitting in red bug juice at tennis camp after eighth grade. And of course it was boys. We're like, you got your period. And some girl who was like 4'10", who I didn't even know, like, came, like, out of her tennis class across to mine and was like, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. You have never seen actual menstrual blood. You wouldn't last 5 goddamn minutes with menstrual cramps. So shut the fuck up or I'll kill all of you. And then she just went back to her class.
Right on.
It was like... Wherever you are, girl whose name I never even got and who was not in the same, like, dorm as me, thank you.
You're a fucking saint, lady.
Yeah, you are. And also, seriously, and these boys were like, for like a day. And then they forgot about it because, like, everybody there was 13 and everybody's got their own problems at that age. So, yeah, I always appreciate, especially with this material and, like, starting my sort of TV analysis career with Dawson's Creek and various other somewhat cardboardy renditions portrayed by 30-year-olds of high school life. It's like, oh, they're actually, like, here's my favorite tertiary talking head kid and our final clip from this section, who it's always nice in a show about teens. Like, you have the ones who look 28, like DeMarcus, but then you also have, like, children still in high school, including this guy who looks like he's about 11 and is amazing. Clip 6.
It wasn't clear that it was poop until someone shouted, "It's poop!" And then everyone knew.
Yeah. Cool story.
That's the way it happens, buddy.
I know. Can you tell that again? He's the best. He has some other clip that I wound up, like... I could either do 6 clips or I could do 60. So I tried to restrain myself, but I don't think we're going to be telling anyone anything that they don't know. But this season was, I was reading reviews, including by the great Alan Sepinwall, who were like, you know, the season suffers a little bit from the fact that Peter and Sam aren't in it as much. Would you agree with that?
I don't know. I, you know, my only thought about what maybe took away from it, was that you kind of had, like, the multiplicity of endings. You kind of had, like, Return of the King syndrome where you're like, that was a really good show. Glad we found out what happened. No, that's not what happened.
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay. That's what happened. Well, I'm glad that we did. That was a really, hold on. And that kind of took a little momentum out of it for me. But I think, what saved that, I think from a pacing standpoint, that maybe wasn't the best way of doing it, but I thought it was a nice counterbalance to the crime because the crime happens to almost everyone. And so the shame of what happens is evenly dispersed among people. Like, it can't really become a means of, like, putting down your fellow student because it happened to us all. which was nice because it sort of defanged that anxiety. And then also in this way, the crime had a diffusion of responsibility too, that I think also underlined the fact that really almost anybody would be susceptible to the impulses behind it. I thought this was, I thought in what they did with the end was even more humane than the first season, which was kind of a, you know, astounding because I was stunned at how good the first season was. More humane and more complex. I mean, they managed to get a lot more kind of current issues of, like, you know, academic cover-ups, prizing athletes.
Yeah, that was a whole, you know, that was another thing that I was like, but they don't asterisk it, which is the great thing. And that's one of the things that makes his speech so good too, that he's like, you know, I know what's up with Lou, but I don't ever really know what's up with anyone in terms of whether they like me for me or not. So anyway, sorry, continue.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I just, I think everybody is going to be a little bit down. I can understand critics going like, it wasn't as good just because, you know, how many times can you see a note perfect, tonally lovely parody of a documentary? Oh my God. But, you know, the novelty is going to wear off some. I think that's probably where I think maybe, you know, this feels like something where as time goes on, so, you know, people can easily revisit it and go, you know what, now that the novelty is off both of them, and I've lived with, you know, season one and season two as their own sort of like discrete texts, I can see that like season two is even more ambitious because it had to overcome more. And like, in terms of like where it made contact with those pitches, like it succeeded, I think, on margin more than the first one did, even if it's not going to be as pure an experience as when you first sit down and watch it and you're like, who drew the dicks?
Well, yeah. And I think the general consensus is that it's, you know, because it's not new, we do have higher expectations for it, and it might inevitably fall a little short because we're not going to be able to see this property for the first time ever again. Like, we already know what it is and what it does and how well it can do it. But I think that it felt emboldened from the success of the first season to really like, maybe without even trying, try to do something bigger, if that makes sense, and unpack the social media landscape in high schools and a whole lot of other secondary things that we see repeating over and over again societally and in true crime, like NCAA violations, catfishing, school shootings, any other mass shooting, frankly, and that it gets all of these things into this, into these eight episodes, which are pretty much the right length. I didn't feel like it was too long, and they weren't underlining and starring their work, and it's really well done. Look, we are mostly talking about serious topics on this podcast, and sometimes an elegant segue is not possible. Also, I am your host, so that pretty elegant much rules segue out the elegant segue. Jeb, this was your suggestion, this topic. Do you want to give us a little bit of background on why you wanted us to talk about the Doodler murders, and in particular, this piece of writing on them?
Honestly, in part, it's because I don't actually consume a ton of true crime. And I was thinking of, when I was thinking of pieces about true crime, it was all stuff like, you know, an 8,000 word New Yorker article on the science of like arson investigation and like how we interpret the path of flame and stuff like that.
That
would just
be
like
a fantastic piece, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you know what about it. And like, and I was thinking of them, I was like, well, they've probably already done it, one, or two, like, I'm not sure I'm smart enough to talk about it. And I guess just what popped into my head, this one, because, my friend Elon Green wrote the piece in The All about it. And it's about a series of murders, around about a dozen people killed. Not all of them are certain to have been committed by a person who was named the Doodler or the Black Doodler. But it happened in San Francisco, and I grew up and I never heard a word about it. And part of what I was thinking about was like American Vandal, like what makes some of it so great is like the really kind of fleshed out sense of awareness of a culture that is, you know, a non-dominant culture. I mean, they're kids versus, you know, they're kids in an institution. The institution exists to institutionalize them. They are not in control. And whatever their culture might be and whatever incidents might be of importance to them, it's not perceived by the authorities in the way that they do. There's a breakdown of empathy and understanding. And to me, like reading Elon's story about this, of like, you know, a marginalized community in this, the one city in the world where they're supposed to not be marginalized. And something like this can just essentially fade from view because, it, you know, for the overclass, it's not important. And in this case, the story of it is essentially that from 1974 to 75 in San Francisco, about a dozen people were killed by witnesses described a black man who was of an educated background who would go into gay clubs and gay restaurants and sketch patrons and then invite them out to a hookup in a public park or any other sort of like secluded area and would stab them in the front and the back, sometimes extraordinarily violently, like dozens and dozens of times, slitting throats, stuff like that. And essentially like the slow response of the community to it. And, you know, even years later, we have there are lots of ways you can question the response of the San Francisco PD, which, you know, might be in San Francisco, but in the 1970s might have had Harvey Milk and we might think of it as a gay paradise, but the old ethnic beat cops, like ethnic Irish and Italians really didn't give a shit. In the same way that, you know, you can see like even in just in the last, 5 years we had, thanks to a Justice Department investigation, we found out that in spite of, you know, beautiful multicultural California and liberal San Francisco, just like tons of Klan jokes being circulated among police about, the native non-white population. And, anyway, that was the genesis of why I picked it.
This was an excellent piece. And
too short.
Yeah, it is a little short. But it's also the only real material about these murders. And actually, a past guest, and SFist contributor, Eve Beatty, had talked about, or mentioned these murders because there was like a bulletin sent out from the SFPD, like cold case PR unit, that was sort of countermanded like 2 days later. Like, you know, despite what you may have heard on like some news story, like there have been no developments in this case and there will be no further announcements. And then there was no follow-up to that. This happened around the end of June, early July. So we were sort of like, you know, looking at that story and like Eve was sort of sitting on it to see if there was any further follow-up. But I found it really fascinating. We were talking about the fact that, you know, some tabloid news mag on TV must have done something about this at some point. Nothing. I looked and I went through all the usual suspect podcasts. A couple of true crime podcasts sort of did episodes on it or mentioned it in passing, but it's really, you know, and Elon's piece is fantastic. And I also like it because there's like explicit mention of the fact that he's like paying homage or like collecting the excellent journalistic work of people at the Sentinel and the Advocate from the time and just footnoting them to make sure that they don't get lost. But
yeah, like, that was a really nice touch of him.
But like pushing it to like that the story hasn't I guess gone to the next level as we would see it here in the teens of the 20th century. So like there hasn't been a serial or an In the Dark about it. The like Liz Garbus isn't doing anything on it. Like where is the American crime story about this? Because I think that would be amazing. I would watch the hell out of that, but you know, I wonder if it's not because, unfortunately, the narrative here is very, you know, nasty, brutish, and short. To wit, it was the mid-70s, there was a lot of other shit going on, and this was an era in which, even in San Francisco, police were referring to murders in this community as homicides, and just not caring. And then witnesses who had survived attacks were extremely reluctant to come forward or to push the police on what was being done. So maybe that's why this hasn't gotten the, quote, prestige treatment, this story, is because what story? After 40 years, like, what else can happen with it?
Yeah, and I mean, there are certainly, like, elements that are interesting enough, but you would have just, I think, lots of baseless speculation. So he supposedly, you know, a couple people escaped attacks on themselves by the doodler. One of whom was allegedly a diplomat. One of whom was allegedly a celebrity.
Yes.
And in the piece, Elon winds up calling Richard Chamberlain's representative.
I know.
which like you just kind of picked a few at random. Like I'm not really sure. I mean, like good. I mean, not a bad call, I guess. But like. It was just sort of funny, but like, I think,
it wasn't him. It was the guy. I actually pulled this quote because I thought it was so funny. That paragraph ends with, a stony no comment from Chamberlain's manager. But I think he was talking to, Randall Alfred, who was the news editor of the Sentinel at the time. And he said, like, was it Johnny Ray? Was it Rock Hudson, Richard Chamberlain?
Okay. All right.
And like, it flights were cheap between LA and San Francisco. Basically, like, it could have been a lot of people.
Yeah.
Who weren't out. Yeah. So.
So yeah, you've got the people who you know. So there's a whole bunch of factors holding it back. I think that there's the stuff to speculate on, but there aren't like letters to the press. You know, like the Zodiac Killer didn't kill more people than the Doodler, but he had way better PR.
Yeah.
But yeah, you've got like reluctant witnesses, the years gone by, the fact that it's not a story that, you know, I mean, I think if you're a producer of a podcast like Serial and you want people to listen, like maybe you're going, well, you know, how jazzed are people going to be about, cops who are acting like there were no people involved, right. when a body was found and then right. the bad guy might be a black guy, which, you know, that's, I don't think anybody. If you're running like a more of a woke true crime podcast, like obsessing over which black guy did it probably feels like a little fraught.
Yeah.
Especially when there are so many, like you could pick like one of which, I mean, like that alone makes it like a fascinating kind of aberrant detail. In the same way that like women serial killers are just sort of like more galvanic. Cause you just expect it to be like a white guy between like 28 and 40.
Yeah.
But like, you know, why is, so you've got the alternative of like, well, do I do a potentially like, you know, like less appealing podcast or more problematized podcast or whatever, or do I just go pick like one of 100 guys who are aged, you know, whatever to 40
well, there's,
white and
yeah, there's,
traveling salesman.
Yeah. Like there's always the danger too, that like, there just isn't a there anymore. Like, not to be picking on Missing Maura Murray, but whatever. Actually, I like to pick on Missing Maura Murray, but their original brief was, we're going to make a documentary about how preoccupied people on the internet are with this case and what makes it such a sticky, fascinating case that people obsess over. And then they ended up just like caught in the machine, basically. And their podcast was them obsessing over minutiae. like, if I never hear the phrase rag in the tailpipe again, it will be too soon. Fortunately, I'm not likely to since I stopped listening to it. But if they had stuck to making the documentary and keeping the podcast like about that process, that could have been interesting because there's the actual story and then there's, you know, the story of the story. So maybe that's one way into it, is to, like make a documentary about making a documentary about this case, but that's above my pay grade. Maybe you need someone like Nick Broomfield, who is not everyone's respectful cup of meat when it comes to this stuff, but he does have some experience with California serial killers that everybody ignored because they were preying on, quote, marginal communities. That's a package containing two problems. First of all, is your aim to solve the thing? And second of all, if your aim isn't to solve the thing, but just to come up with like a ripping yarn, then are you sort of exploiting the crime and the victims and everyone involved? So I don't know the answer to that. But I do think that enough people know about the existence of this case that I would be surprised if we didn't hear some kind of development news about it in the next year or two, would you say?
I don't, Elon's piece came out a while ago.
Did he get any traction from that? Or
I asked him about it. God, I want to say like maybe 9 months ago, I ran into him. And interestingly, like he's at work on another, like, on a book on kind of something like similar marginalized communities. And I assume it's going to be awesome. So I'm not here to plug my own work. I go on podcasts and just like plug what Elon Green is up to. That's just my thing.
Okay, cool. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, and like I asked, I was like, did you ever hear anything back? And I don't remember him saying like, you know, I finally got a call from a, you know, like a detective asking if I'd heard anything or, you know, there wasn't like any flurry on it. I worry, you know, if you were to try to do a podcast on it, like, or, you know, especially like a longer one, it would wind up a lot like that really good old like This American Life one about like the kid finds this abandoned like spooky house. Do you remember, you know what I'm talking about?
No.
It's one of the rare episodes of This American Life where it's just one story.
Okay.
And I'll look it up and we can put it in the show notes for people to listen to. But like it's one of those things where you spend like 45 minutes getting deeper and deeper into like what could this mean, and then like the reveal is just extremely normal. Like it's not like, you know, like, okay, yeah, I could see how this would be like terrifying or frightening or like, you know, unsettling to other people. But it's like, if you'd just gone to county records and like looked up the deed or something, like one of those things where like it really was a relatively short coincidental number of steps from mystery to explanation. And I kind of in like, it is for as like, not like electric, but yeah, kind of like tingling and chilling. I remember my wife and I listened to it when she just had like laser eye surgery, so she couldn't open her eyes. So we were listening to like lots of podcasts.
Yikes.
And she was getting like the really good like spooky radio theater experience because she's just basically in the dark.
Wow.
But like I kind of feel like unless you get any more movement on this, you would be doing like, oh, here's a bunch of episodes of like really, really interesting speculation. It's like, and then what's going on currently with the case? Absolutely nothing. Nothing.
Well, yeah. Like, I did pull a clip from, this podcast called Murder Road Trip, which is, this, American host and her frequent, I believe, Kiwi guest, get in the car and go to places where murders occurred and occasionally argue about whether In-N-Out Burger is the superior burger chain. I'm not sure.
I'm not taking your bait.
Oh, I'm a vegetarian. I don't give a shit. You hate it, love it. That's fine. I'm unclear on whether they actually get in an actual car and go places together. I think they do. I had just never heard of this podcast, but I think it's fairly sizable. This episode, which I stopped listening to about halfway through, I'm not sure if it's typical, but in the snippet that I'm about to play, I think you see what anyone who is trying to create compelling narrative from this case might be up against in terms of like creating suspense. Here's clip 7.
That is interesting because they found money in his pocket, but it didn't list that they found a wallet, which is where I assume you would keep your money and your identification. maybe the killer took the wallet so that there wasn't an identification. That's a really good observation.
Yeah, because I'm thinking that if the men mainly met the killer at bars and restaurants and nightclubs, I'm not sure I would go out to a bar or a restaurant or a nightclub without my wallet. I would take my ID. I'd want to have some money with me as well as some money in my pocket, because you never know.
I mean, okay, we got it. But this is the issue. Like, of course the killer just took the ID to slow down the investigation so he wouldn't be caught. Like, this was a fairly savvy, organized killer. I don't think there's that much more to it, but they're in that missing Maura Murray position of having to just masticate every piece of information they do have. Because another thing that I noticed in Elon's piece, she says, like, she knows him, Mr. Green's piece, is that he had no luck contacting families or survivors or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think just plain couldn't find them, never mind could get them to talk to him. So, you know, that is an issue. Like, some of this stuff is pretty straightforward, and, like, never mind when you get to the end and it's like, oh, it's because of this completely predictable thing that was one of the two obvious choices. It's like everything leading up to that is just as obvious. So,
yeah, but like, you could just talk to somebody's family member, though, and have them say, like, oh, no, he went out with his ID all the time. Like, he mainly rode the bus. So, like, he wouldn't bring it. You know, he was over 30. He didn't get carded.
Yeah.
You know, he would usually just go out with cash and his house key. He was like, because he liked to wear tight pants. He didn't want him to a wallet to break up the lines on his pants or something like that. And you're like, oh, well, all the conclusions I just tried to extrude from this one thing, like, they're all BS.
Yeah. And then it's like, well, why are we here? Like, why was this 6 hours of podcast? Right. So I guess that explains that, but I feel like maybe something is happening. Like, that false alarm on the, there will be a press conference about this case. Like, it just suggests to me that something, the universe has something planned for the case. But listeners, if what the universe has planned for you is reading the basically single piece of material that gathers everything in one place in an organized and well-written manner, Elon Green's piece will be in our show notes. You got anything else on this, Jeb?
I'm just going to say a cop did it.
Huh. Okay.
Off-duty cop problems with his own sexuality.
Okay.
And I just like to blame cops. That's kind of my thing.
Okay.
I'm working on thinking about working, branching out into blaming like firefighters and EMTs.
Mm.
You know, next, kind of like open myself up to new experiences. I don't know. I got nothing.
Okay. All right. I have even less than that, but I will take that theory under advisement. Where else can listeners find you blaming cops / Jack Wagner for various things that have occurred? In
Jack Wagner, huh? Funny that you bring that up.
is it?
Yes. You were a guest on probably like episode 19 of our podcast. David J. Roth, editor extraordinaire at Deadspin, and I review Hallmark original movies. And we try not to be mean. So that's why we named it Dave and Jeb Aren't Mean. It's not necessarily like a description. It's an aspiration, because some of these are, you know, they're kind of turkeys. But we're on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and Facebook.com/ It's Christmas Town. We've got, I think, like 24 hours are behind a paywall on Patreon, and that works out to like $3 a month. So it's 10 cents a day if you want to hear the old ones. And then new ones, are Stitcher and iTunes. And supposedly you're coming back to do a Wedding March 2 for more Wagner.
Yeah, indeed. Wagner. You can't be trying that hard not to be mean, or you wouldn't have had me on this podcast. I did try to gentle my role, but they did not make it easy with those wigs. Got a tip for the Blotter Presents? You can find me on social media at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com or become an official Blotter tipster at the Blotter's Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you're not feeling spendy but you still like the podcast, you can rate and review it on iTunes if you haven't already. My guest has been Jeb Lund, and he is on Twitter at, is it Mobute?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mobute.
Mouse. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.